So our text for today is Othello. Before we come to talk about it, let me make sure that you all have copies of the information about the paper topic. Is anybody who doesn't have this document? This has been a very carefully crafted exercise that is designed, we hope, to get you working as close to the text of the language of the plays as is possible. And we are happy for you to expand your thinking beyond these passages. In fact, we invite that in our description. But we very much want everything you argue to have its basis in the language of the plays. And so we also felt that this would be a kind of paper, and we discussed this a little bit last time, which, since it is so focused and the passages are presented to you, will take you, we hope, less time to assemble than would be something where you had to sort of go out and hunt down the selected passages that you're going to work with. So there, you'll see that there's the expectation here that you're going to partner this with some other passages that you observe from the plays. So have a look at this. Maybe at the beginning, right after break, we can see if there are questions about this document. And when it says here 3 to 5 pages, that's double-spaced with normal margins, okay? Which means margins, not no margins. Questions about this at all? Okay. Okay, so we move on to Othello, and I'm guessing that this is a play with which you are more familiar than you have been with the previous two, or at least more culturally familiar, that it's a play that you have perhaps seen, perhaps heard about or heard of, and that it's a play to which you are willing to grant some degree of what used to be called greatness. That is to say, that it's an important play. It's a play that has had an effect upon culture and institutions. I thought we might begin by just listing some topics that you think this play brings up or ought to bring up. So the floor is open. Yes?
Race.
Race, indeed. Okay. Others?
Evil.
Excellent. What else? Okay, I'm going to call that loves, okay? Loves with a... Cool, okay? Sir?
Jealousy,
indeed. Okay. And what else?
Order and chaos.
So a theme familiar from the plays that we have already been looking at, indeed. Yes? Whatever the opposite of honesty turns out to be, falsity would be one of the many, many, many options here. Yes?
Introspection.
Say more about what you mean by introspection.
Well, knowing thyself.
Ah, can we call it self-knowledge? Okay. Okay. Because introspection is also a very... So, sorry, self-knowledge. Introspection is also a very pertinent notion here, since Othello in particular spends some time thinking about how he's thinking about himself thinking. The great introspective figure in this play is who? Who is it who spends a lot of time?
Iago,
exactly. And the degree to which self-knowledge is or is not itself a sufficient good or an indication of either trustworthiness or virtue or anything like that is obviously a set of issues that this play brings up. Anything else that you... Yes?
Class.
Class. Very good. Okay. And maybe we want to partner that with nation a little bit, or nationality, or I don't know exactly what one wants to call the difference between Florence and Venice, or the difference between Mauritania and Venice, or whatever it is. But let's call it nation or place, just as a placeholder. Something else? Yes? I think maybe yes, that it will. But honor, of course, honor and honest both have a kind of physiological, I mean, we still have honor killings today in today's news, which are all about the supposed sexual violation of a woman who is thought of as the property of a man. And this question of your honor as actually the physical sign of virginity, or virginity as the women have physical honor and men have spiritual honor, so to speak, this physical metaphorical issue is actually quite germane. Yes?
Reputation versus sort of private interaction.
Okay, great. Yes, please, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Oh, women's rights.
Okay, good. So women's rights. Great. Okay. Let's imagine that you all leave the room and then you come back in and you see these things on the board. Are you easily able to guess which Shakespeare play it is that we are discussing? Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think there, yes. Yeah, well, okay, so let's talk about that. Because there have been decades and decades in which people denied that this play had anything whatever to do about race. The first half of the 20th century, even though we can talk about what is a moor and what did Shakespeare think a moor was, and we'll talk about that in just a second. But there have been many critics, especially say from post-World War II period through the 60s, through the early 60s, who wanted to claim that Othello's race was an incidental issue, that he was a sign, that to talk about his race was to take away something about his universal humanity, and that it in fact aligned you with the bad readers or the prejudiced readers within the play. Now, obviously, to us this seems like a very, very narrow reading, but it was thought of as a very liberal reading at the time, that looking past his race, that a colorblind reading of Othello was, for some critics, thought of as a more elevated, that, you know, didn't get them in the trap of being like Brabante or being like Iago, that one should like Desdemona, see Othello's visage in your mind, and that you wouldn't see color, you would see his generosity or his majesty or his magnificence or something like that. So that it seems to us the most obvious thing is precisely that this is a play about race, about color, about racial difference, but I assure you that very many great critics in the middle of the last century wanted to say that that was an incidental issue and not a central issue, and that the central issue was to look past the surface at with Desdemona as your model here. Yes?
With the whole dichotomy between honesty and falsity, and also the reputation versus, you know, what really happens in private, aren't they kind of intertwined? You can't really separate Othello's skin from what's inside of him, because the two things, the outside and inside of a person, interact so much in the play. They're both equally important in the play.
Well, I think that you could make an argument to that point, but I can cite you chapter and verse of people who say that is a surface reading of the play. The play is really about, you know, manhood or humanity or seeing through the surface rather than seeing the surface. Just to give you a little bit of kind of stage history in connection with this, There's a difference between how the play is read with the eye and performed as well. People like John Quincy Adams and Abigail Adams, for example, famously found that seeing the play performed, and of course in England in the 18th century, the actor playing Othello was a white man in black paint, not an African or a man of African descent. But seeing the black man kiss the white woman was for these liberal speakers intolerable. They found themselves unable to watch this or unable to be comfortable watching it, even though in their reading of the play, they found liberality and generosity and virtues of all kinds in Othello. Nonetheless, being confronted with the physical fact of an interracial marriage, of an interracial love affair, their response as viewers was different from their response as readers, where the color is a piece of information rather than an epithet, often something that is thrown at Othello from outside. Who talks about Othello's color? Desdemona's father does. What's his name? Brabantio. What does he have to say about it? A maiden never bold to fall in love with what she feared to look on. The idea, I mean, his fantasy of his daughter, about as much at odds as Othello's fantasy of why it is that Desdemona fell in love with him. Everybody seems to sort of underread Desdemona, but his fantasy of Desdemona is that she, what do we know about Desdemona's past history as an adult woman with suitors? Is this her very first romance? Is it? She's turned down other people. And do we have any description of the other people that she's turned down? The curled darlings of the nation. So the idea here is that these are the sort of matinee idols, the dandies. I think we have to assume that these are Venetian princes, that these are insiders who are very stylish and very, you know, this is again Brabantio's language. So he wants to oppose this outsider Othello to the curled darlings of the nation. That she has refused or declined the suits of other men, and then she picks this one. And why would she pick this one? So we talk in a second about why she would pick this one. Who else though talks about? Othello's color. Yes? Othello does. What does he say about it?
His blackness, his black face.
What, do you remember any lines that he speaks? Yeah, in the back. I'll repeat it, Larry. That's okay. Go ahead.
Well, there's a line at the end, I can't remember it exactly, but something along the lines of, my soul has become as black as my skin after his murder of Desdemona.
Well, even earlier, haply for I am black and have not those soft parts of conversation that chamberers have. What are chamberers in this, in a sentence like that? Haply for I am black and have not those soft parts of conversation that chamberers have. What's a chamberer, do you think? What's a chamber? Chamber is a room. Chamber is a room. So what is a chamberer? Exactly. So it's again a diplomat or a courtier or somebody who's indoors rather than outdoors. I think have not those soft parts of conversation. I'm not good with language. Now, of course, he's fabulous with language. This is the contradiction that all critics find. That Wilson Knight once famously called the Othello music, this wonderful flowing language that belongs to Othello, is something that he disparages and says, I can't talk good courtier speak. So his self-doubt, if it is self-doubt, is connected to, haply means, you know, perhaps, because I'm black or because I don't have the right courtly language, this might be one reason why she might, in fact, be unfaithful to me. So somewhere in him is this self-identification as black, but it doesn't, of course, come out at the very, very beginning. Who at the very beginning of the play talks? I mean, we have Brabantio. Who else? Iago. And who's Iago talking to at the beginning of the play? Rodrigo. So look at the frame of the play. The play begins, and this is so true of many, many Shakespeare plays altogether, particularly the tragedies. It begins with an intimate conversation before a big public scene. And in this intimate conversation, you learn something of the backstory of what you're about to see. So before you see the hero, before you see Othello, before you see King Lear, before you see Macbeth, you're going to hear Iago and Rodrigo in this case. In the case of King Lear, you're going to hear the Gloucester brothers talking. In the case of Macbeth, you're going to hear the witches talking. In each case, some expectations are you know, true ones or false ones, are going to be set up for you before the stage brightens and you see the hero. And in this case, when I say the stage brightens, I mean this very, very advisedly. I could have put night and day on this list too, because so much of the play takes place in the dark. Why is it important that the opening scenes of the play take place in the dark? Why are they most dramatically effective because they take place in the dark? Sir?
Quite what's going on. There's this mystery that's drummed up, I think, especially in those the scenes where everything happens very quickly.
There's several scenes like that, but yes, you're quite right. That because Iago does this several times. He wants to create a kind of tumult. He does this with Rodrigo at the beginning of the play, where he gets him to shout under Brabantio's window, and it's confused noise, it's epithets, it's an old black ram is tupping your white hue, the idea that awake, 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 go to your money bags, and so forth. Same thing will happen in Cyprus when he wants to create this fight between Rodrigo and Cassio again. That it's at night, the bell is clanging, that there's confusion because it's night. And these voices come out of the dark. And they seem to be, when Brabantio says so chillingly, this accident is not unlike my dream. What you're telling me about, this idea that my daughter has left the house and is actually in bed with Othello, he's already dreamed it. He's already imagined it. So that it's night, and this is like a dream for him, but it's the nightmare come true. And, of course, it's described in the most vivid and aversive animal imagery. Now, when Rodrigo talks about Othello's color, how does he describe him? Does anybody remember? Rodrigo, who's not an elegant person at all, calls him, among other things, a thick lips. That he is particularly pointing at his race as well as his color. And this phrases like that, and Rodrigo is what you would call in a novel an unreliable narrator, not necessarily somebody who speaks the truth here, because he may be lumping together all persons of color and picking physiological characteristics because he does not distinguish among them. The big debate among critics of this play has been, you know, where does Othello come from? Is he a northern or a southern African? Does he look like a Moor with Caucasoid features? Does he look like a sub-Saharan African? Sir? Thick lips is what he says, yes. But the question is, do we believe Rodrigo? I mean, Rodrigo is in many, many ways an untrustworthy and unsophisticated person. When he says the thick lips, when he uses this as an epithet, do we actually think that Othello has a particular kind of physical formation, or does this just belong to a kind of grab bag of terms that Rodrigo is using to distinguish a race other than his own, or a nation other than his own? But because there are confusing, different. Where, for example, does the handkerchief come from? From Egypt, yes, an Egyptian charmer gave it, so quite far away from southern Africa. So we get different kinds of signals in this play as to where Black Othello might come from. And there are at least two strong theatrical traditions of the Black Othello and of the tawny Moor, tawny here being brown rather than black, And two very distinct acting traditions have emerged out of this. If you've seen the Olivier film and before that the play of Othello, he's very blacked up. And it's a caricature, really, of a kind of, it's almost like a minstrel show. But there are portraits in the period, for example, of the Moorish ambassador, very elegant portraits in which he's quite light-skinned. Moors are, this is Mauritania, it's Libya, it's the very northern part of Africa, it's the southern part of the Mediterranean. So the question of Othello's race, even if we acknowledge that race is important, is not fully determined in this play, that there are lots of different ways of performing it and lots of different ways of understanding it. Whether it matters or not how black Othello is, since they describe him constantly as black and he calls himself black, is another question. But the location from which he comes and his connection to Moorishness is somewhat in dispute, is one of the mysteries of these plays. In fact, what is Othello's own background? Where does he come from? How is he described? Rodrigo calls him famously an extravagant and wheeling stranger of here and everywhere. And what does stranger mean in this case? What's the force behind a word like stranger? Yes? It's exactly right.
A Florentine practically was a stranger or
absolutely. No, it's a strong word. It doesn't merely mean someone new to town. It means not us. It means someone estranged from us, someone strange as well as a stranger. We might put a slightly different positive spin on it and say exotic. I mean, and indeed, this is a moment in early modern history in which there is a lot of exploration and discovery, in which people from North American Indian tribes are brought, and from Africa are brought to England and put on display and integrated into society and so forth. There's a kind of a cultural plus to being a stranger as well as a cultural minus to being a stranger. But the idea is that this is not us, that this is, and indeed the Othello, a lot of Othello's power comes precisely from his mobilizing both his strangeness and also his capacity in the service of the state. Because what is his rank? What is his role? What's his job? He's a general. I mean, they need him. They need him more than, they do not have a general who is not a stranger. They do not have a Venetian general. Indeed, do they have a Venetian army as far as we can see? Who is his lieutenant? Cassio. And where does Cassio come from? From Florence. Quite different from Venice. What are Venice's attributes in this period, or as you can extrapolate it from the play? Merchants, yes, okay. So it's on the water. It's a crossroads. They are merchants. It's a mercantile culture. It's a cosmopolitan culture. It's a place where people come and go. But it's very much a place of exchange. And it's very much a place of change as a result. And in this play, as in what is Shakespeare's other Venice play? Merchant of Venice also has a black figure. The Duke of Morocco? No, Prince of Morocco. Also the same question about women and money, women and worth, women exchanged for other women, and so forth, in the exchange among men. So Venice has its own particularities, and we learn something about Venice at the beginning of the play in this question of Venice's enemies, Venice's war. Who is Venice at war with? With the Turks, okay. The Turks are making for Cyprus. One of my favorite moments in the play is the moment in which somebody comes in and says, the Turks are headed for Rhodes. And the answer is, this cannot be by no essay of reason. Rhodes is a tougher enemy and less desired than Cyprus, so it must be for Cyprus that they are headed. And so indeed, a new messenger comes in and says, no, that was a feint. Their ships have turned around, and now they're headed frankly for, that is, you know, openly for Cyprus. So this, and 'tis a pageant to keep us in false gaze. That's what they have to say. about the fact that the Turks seem to be going to Rhodes, and then they turn around and they go back to Cyprus. And this notion of the whole play as a pageant to keep us in false gaze, as a set of plays within the play, a set of spectacles to have us looking in the wrong direction or gathering the wrong information or coming to the wrong conclusion. For me, that happens in scene after scene after scene. It's so many of these scenes are set up as plays within the play, with onstage spectators watching something happen, watching but not being able to hear. What scene might one think of in that connection? Yes?
Cassio and Othello to talk about Desdemona, but he's really talking to Cassio about Bianca.
Exactly. So by this time, about two-thirds of the way through the play, Iago has got Othello to think that Cassio is making the running with Desdemona, that he's been having an affair with her, that he's much more elegant, more beautiful, he's a curled darling, and so forth, and that it was logical that somehow she might be interested in Cassio. But Othello wants the ocular proof, he wants to see, and then there's this wonderful scene in which Iago says, you know, would you behold her, would you, the supervisor, behold her topped? Would you actually want to watch them having sex together? So you get, as you do in that opening scene with the old black ram, tupping the white ewe, it's that same topping word, this vivid image of what is not happening, this vivid image of the sex between Cassio and Desdemona that is not taking place. And so what he sets up is a little false scene in which Othello, like Troilus watching with Ulysses, the little scene between Diomede and Cressida, Othello is watching a scene among Iago, or between Iago and Cassio, in which you're quite right. Iago sets it up so that it's clear that they're talking about a woman, but we can tell that it's about Bianca. Who is Bianca? She's a courtesan, she's a prostitute, she's in love with Cassio, she's the one to whom he gives the handkerchief to take out the work, and her name means white. So here we have a play in which the whore has the name that means white, and in which black Othello is the figure of outraged virtue or of steadfastness or of whatever you think he is, because we're going to come and talk a little bit more about what you think about Othello. But in this scene, precisely, Othello is positioned so he can see, but he cannot hear, and we can't hear everything that's being said. He can't hear the word Bianca when it's whispered. And so he misinterprets what he sees as two men joking about, coarsely, about a woman whom he thinks is his wife, whom he thinks is Desdemona. And scene after scene in this play gets set up in that way, so that there is a pageant to keep us in false gaze. There's a spectacle that we see and don't fully, or are enabled to misinterpret. And the very first scene is exactly such a scene. The scene in which Iago first gets Rodrigo on his side and then stages this outcry underneath the doors of Brabantio's palace in Venice. Why is Rodrigo a good confederate for Iago? He's certainly gullible. What's his interest, though? He desires Desdemona. He's in love with her. He has not succeeded with her. And what does Iago promise him? Yes, and have her in the most physical way, that she may not love him, but Iago's going to work it out so that they have sex, or that at least we can get rid of this. Because to Rodrigo, a Venetian, again, the stranger Othello is the worst possible rival here, because nominally unworthy. Why not pick Rodrigo? Why does Iago have such strong feelings about Othello? Anyone? Let's get the microphones working here. Yes?
He gives us a lot of reasons.
Okay, what are some of his
reasons?
One
of them is that Cassio has been chosen over him to be Othello's lieutenant.
Yes, Cassio has been preferred to him. And what attributes does Cassio have that Iago resents?
he's a mathematician. Maybe
what does it mean?
He's educated.
Arithmetician is what the text says. And what does it mean?
Is he just educated? I mean, is he
He's educated
more sophisticated?
And he's a book soldier. Okay. He's a desk soldier, we would say. He's not a fighter. He's not somebody who has earned his place on the battlefield. He is a tactician. He's a theoretician. He's an intellectual. He's also a Florentine. And what are the attributes of Florence that you can deduce from this play? Yes?
Elegance.
Elegance, okay. So, but name me a famous Florentine of this period. Sorry? The Medici, absolutely, absolutely. But let's not forget Machiavelli either, Florence is a place of policy and also a place of wealth and of art. And Iago himself, this is where the word class may come in. In certain productions that you may have seen of this play, 20th century productions, 21st century productions, the Iago figure is a kind of working class soldier. If you've seen the Lawrence Fishburne film with Kenneth Branagh in the place of Iago, he's a plain speaking, rough hewn underclass figure. The same is true of the Frank Finlay figure in the Olivier Othello. That the attempt is made to make a distinction of class as well as of nation among these figures. So jealousy of Cassio is and the idea that his proper place has been given to Cassio is one motive that he speaks. What are his other supposed motives? Please.
Iago believes that Othello had it with his wife.
Yes, it is said that he has leapt into my seat. Notice all these. Again, what kind of a figure is that? I mean, what's... It's an animal figure, exactly. It's maybe the horseman getting into the horse or whatever it is. But it's I fear Cassio with my nightcap too. He says that the sexual jealousy is another claim that he makes, that somehow Othello has had an affair with Emilia. How many of you believe that Othello's had an affair with Emilia? No evidence in the play about this. Any other things that Iago suggests about? Yes.
Well, at one point he says, "I just hate Othello."
Yes, I hate the Moor. I hate the Moor. Exactly. There are these moments when he says, "You know, I am not what I am, and I hate the Moor." He says it twice in that opening scene. I hate the Moor. It's as if the reasons are either spoken for himself or spoken for us. Coleridge very famously, once upon a time, said about Iago that he had motiveless malignity, that his evil was unmotivated or that it exceeded any particular motive, that he was an incarnate figure of evil. Some people have written about this play with Othello, with Iago in the figure of what Othello almost calls him at the end of the play, a devil or a demi-devil. But this phrase motiveless malignity has had a lot of success. People have also pushed against it and say, no, in fact, he has motives. He's not merely an allegorical figure of evil. It's not just about the intrinsic evil that lurks in the hearts of men. But in fact, this is a highly particular figure. Nonetheless, his I hate the Moor is, so to speak, the top line and the bottom line here. Does he also love the Moor? When does he say that?
He says it all the time. I don't remember exactly where, but he says it, and Othello says it to him. That's what I was so struck by. Everybody's saying how much they love everybody.
Right. Well, and of course, love, as you suggested, has a lot of different valences here, too. But this is very much a play about triangles and quadrangles and so forth. And of course, it culminates in that moment in the middle of the play, when Othello thinks that he's learned the truth about Desdemona, and they kneel together on the stage, and at this moment, and for me this is a crucial, crucial moment in the play, Othello says to Iago, because of course he says to him, "Now art thou my lieutenant, And Iago says to him in reply, remember, I am your own, or I am thy own forever. So that's the moment, I mean, it seems to me always like a kind of marriage ceremony, in which the two rivals have been gotten rid of, the two figures who Othello chooses over Iago at the beginning of the play are the lieutenant Cassio and the beloved Desdemona. And in that one moment, this cleverness of Iago's strategy is that he gets the two of them to knock each other out of the game so that he is left as the one person, honest, honest, honest Iago, whom Othello can trust and against which these former loves become distrusted and hated. Yes?
Motives, I mean, does it really make any difference? Because, I mean, he almost seems to enjoy just being the schemer of setting these things up beautifully. So, as you say, people feud. I mean, he's the puppeteer that sort of pulls everything together, and whether he has the motives or not really makes no difference, because, I mean, he almost becomes a character. There's a lot of characters in the world like that who just love to play with other people and are very good schemers, so to speak.
I think that cannot be underestimated. I think you're quite right, that we see him at the beginning of the play, end of Act One, I have it, it is engendered, Helen Knight must bring this monstrous birth to the world's light. So Iago giving birth, again we have the kind of cross-gender moment, but he enjoys making chaos happen. And he's very good at it. Remember, we looked at the Duke in Measure for Measure as a kind of playwright figure, as a figure who stood behind the sidelines in his friar's hood and tempted Angelo, in this case, to become not the angel but the devil, to turn himself inside out and so forth. Here, too, you have a figure who stands aside. He's never there. If you look to see all these crisis points, shouting under the window, the fight in Cyprus, he's never there. Sometimes he will say, I have to leave now, I'll be back. Just like the friar. He makes people attack one another, and he stands aside, and then, you know, honest Iago, who looks dead with grieving, he becomes the figure to whom Othello will appeal. But the pleasure of creating chaos, as you say, of creating hatred, of breaking things, or of making plays, is very great for him. And when he is finally discomfited at the end of the play, what happens to Iago at the very, very end? Yes?
He goes silent.
Yeah. And this great wordsmith, this great writer of scripts, telling Rodrigo to shout under the window, setting all these things up, from this time forth I never will speak word. He goes silent. It's a kind of living death, and it's a kind of withdrawal into... no longer is he. The play has taken over from him, so to speak. And when they say to him, when the Venetian ambassadors say to him at the end of the play, look at them on the monstrous loading of this bed, it is thy work. We can take that word work to mean not only what you have done, but almost work in the sense of work of art. This spectacle of the dead Othello and the dead Desdemona is what Iago, the playwright, has produced. And to which the response is, the object poisons sight, let it be hid. And we turn away from this spectacle if we do. But the trajectory from all this language and writing these scripts for other people to silence here, to a kind of living death, this is the ultimate discomfiture of the schemer. I think that's right. Yes?
Something. The play's one of the big themes is sexual jealousy, but nobody's having sex. I mean, Othello and Desdemona don't have sex.
You're the analyst. Why are they talking about it? They're not having sex. It's about deferral. The sexual consummation between Othello and Desdemona is constantly being interrupted. It's put up your bright swords for the dew will rust them, is the phrase when they come to him at the Sagittari at the beginning of the play. Sagittari is the archer again, you know, and the shot has not taken place yet. Sagittari is a kind of famous name for inns of this period, but everything in Shakespeare has a kind of signification. Then they go to Cyprus, and they go on separate ships, and oh my fair warrior, and he greets her. And they go off to bed, and again Iago creates a great outcry in the streets. Look, let my gentle love be now waked up, or says Othello, and when the Duke sends him off to war in the middle of the night, which is his wedding night, he says, "This the flinty and steel couch of war has for a soldier is his thrice driven bed of down." That so he's always substituting war for love. It's the opposite. I mean, the great kind of mythological background here is the relationship of Mars and Venus, where the great conquest of Mars by Venus is, and you see this in Renaissance paintings, is where the god Mars, the god of war, is taught to take off his armor and becomes himself defeated by the loves of Venus. And these are wonderful paintings in which the putti, the little cherubs, are playing with the armor, which is now disarmed. But in fact, the sexual consummation is constantly deferred here. That's one of the reasons they talk about it so much and why it figures so much in the action.
Continue with your point that men put work before love, even though he can't stop thinking about love. He's so obsessed with it, but he never does it.
Right. Well, so let's talk a little bit about the courtship of Othello and Desdemona in this regard. Because remember that we get some accounts of this courtship because, just to remind you of where we are in the play, after all this shouting under Brabantio's window, where Brabantio comes, Brabantio again is the father, comes out and says, why talk you me of, what? My house is not a grange, but what's the line before that?
Robbing,
yes, thank you. Why talk me, you me of robbing, that my house is not a grange, with this, remember the grange that we had, the Marion and the moated grange, in Measure for Measure. Here too, we're city people, we're civilized people, nothing bad can happen here, and all this animal imagery, all this farmyard imagery has invaded his dream, his imagination, and then these shouts in the street, and then it all turns out to be true, and he cannot bear it. In fact, what happens to Brabantio toward the end of the play? He dies. We're told, it's a good thing your father didn't live to see this, because this would have broken his heart, which was already broken. But Brabantio then wants to bring this case before the Duke, or he's called the Duke of Venice here, the Doge, the Duke of Venice, who happens to be up sitting in the council chamber in the middle of the night because of the threat of the Turks. So we have immediately, and again, this is very, very characteristic of Shakespeare, the martial and the domestic juxtaposed to one another, that you have war outside and war inside, and notice that not only do they never have sex, they never have war. No sooner do they all sail to Cyprus than it turns out there's been a huge storm that's wiped out the ships of the Turks, and they've all, the survivors have all gone home, there's no war. There they all are in Cyprus for most of the play for no reason whatever, because the ostensible threat, the threat from outside, the threat of the Turks, has been vanquished not by them, but by nature or whatever, by the sea. Leaving, again, revealing what was always there, the instability of the relationships among them. So here we might ask, structurally speaking, because we've talked about this a little bit, why move the action to Cyprus? What's the relationship of Venice to Cyprus? Say again.
Sorry. It's like the opposite of Venice. Venice is the city and culture and everything, and Cyprus is wilderness, kind of like where anything can happen.
Right. Is it really the opposite?
No.
When talks down me of robbing, my house is not a grange. No, exactly. Yeah. Basically, they've already got Cyprus inside them. When they make this transition, like any other green world or middle world in Shakespeare, like the comedies that go from the city to the Forest of Arden, or from the city to the Athenian Wood in Midsummer Night's Dream, or whatever it is, you expose what's already there. So they've already got Cyprus inside them. I'm sure I talked in my chapter about the fact that Cyprus is also the name of Venus, actually. The Cypris is one of the Greek names for Venus. So they're going from Venice to Venus. They're going from the city to the wild place, which we've already seen to be imprinted upon them in the supposedly civilized place of Venice. And they actually never get back to Venice. The whole tragedy takes place in Cyprus. But the ostensible things, the love and war things, never happen in this play in exactly the form that you think they're going to. Instead, they go underground, they resurface in different places, and this is as true of love as it is of war. So who's at war with one another actually in this play?
Certainly Othello, his insecurity is part of the struggle inside of him.
Aha, okay, so that Othello, who initially presents himself as imperturbable. Notice, they come to his inn in the middle of the night, put up your right swords, you will rest them. He's a fighter who's not going to fight. Notice again, at the beginning of the play and the end of the play, we have this business about the swords and whether you're going to use them or not. That in the death scene at the end, they say, "Don't worry, we've taken his sword away from him," and it turns out he's got another sword in his chamber. The business of whether or not this hero actually is going to fight is also, this is of all Shakespeare's martial heroes, this is the one who fights least. Compared to Mark Antony, compared to anybody in Julius Caesar, compared to anybody in the English history plays, this hero doesn't fight. He absolutely does not. And you're quite right that his struggle is within himself, what we call technically a psychomachia, a struggle of the soul, torn between. And this is where we come back to all these dyads, that he sees himself through the eyes that other people see him. I want to talk about the courtship of Brabantio, of Desdemona and Othello in Brabantio's house. Steve, how much time have I got? I have time. Okay. All right. Good. What do we know about what's the scene? Before I ask you how is the courtship scene described to us? Because this is another one of these famous Shakespearean unseens. Yes. Thank you.
It's said that her father asks him to tell the stories of what he was like for him to grow up, and she overhears it just at their table listening, and so she hears what he was like and the adventures he went on and that he was a slave and all these things, and she kind of becomes intrigued by all of these stories.
Right. Who tells us that?
Othello.
Othello, right. So, again, we don't see it. A modern film might show us this scene sort of in black and white or something like this. This is a kind of past scene, but we don't see it. We only get it through Othello's eyes. So my first question to you is, what is Othello doing in Rodrigo's house? In Brabantio's house?
He was invited.
So all of this horror at the idea that Othello could be having sex with his daughter, that his daughter could fall in love with Othello, Brabantio's own relationship to Othello is a very cathected one at the beginning of the play. This is the hero, this is the general, this is the social lion invited to the house and sitting around with the other guys to talk war stories. And Othello is invited, we're told, to tell his own history, which, as you say, is a story of fantastical adventures. What kinds of adventures does he have? Where does he go? What kinds of places has he been? Has he been in courts? He's been cannibals, exactly. Men whose heads do grow beneath their shoulders. Deserts. Okay. So this is the landscape of romance, and I want you to remember that word because we're going to come later in the semester to plays that are often called Shakespearean romances, places that happen in exotic locations that involve shipwrecks and discoveries and so forth. But not for Shakespeare's own time, these are the kinds of stories that people would tell when they went off on explorations. And if you looked at maps done in the period, you would often find images of cannibals or Amazons or some other not us kind of strangers in the margins or in the water off there. Here's where civilization is and over there are the cannibals. Here's where civilization is and over there are the Amazons. These other types of people mark, again, the us from the not us. So that these stories are good stories. These are goods like Odysseus, like or Scheherazade. These are seductive stories of adventures of which this guy sitting in your living room is the hero. And the Othello says, "She loved me for the dangers I had passed, and I loved her that she did pity them, that she was empathetic and a good listener," and so forth. This only is the witchcraft I have used, because of course the claim of Brabantio is that it's what we with witchcraft. Nothing else could make this woman fall in love with a black man than witchcraft. And so he, this is the first of many moments in which language and witchcraft are equated here. This only is the witchcraft I have used. And then it turns out, in fact, that this isn't at all why Desdemona fell in love with him. It wasn't that she pitied him. I saw Othello's visage in his mind. I saw what an interesting, complicated person he was. It's not that I pitied or was empathetic or was like the audience of a tragedy full of pity and fear. It wasn't that I was merely heroizing him, but rather that I had a much more equal kind of relationship to him. But for Othello, this is hero worship. And for Othello, he needs to be the hero in order to be the person she loves. So his notion of why she loves him, as testified to by him, is already something that ought to show us that there are some dangers involved, because it has to do with his wholeness as a spectacle, with a kind of what Bakhtin would call the classic body, the body that of the male hero that cannot be penetrated or entered, that is perfect and closed. And in fact, he turns out to be open and attackable, that he has vulnerabilities, that he has weaknesses, that he has self-doubt, as you say. And it's that he can't, that he thinks that she can't love that. He thinks that she can't love his, what we call complexity, humanity, interiority, that he has to be an outside in order for her to love him. He has to be a seamless surface without self-doubt and without interior dialogue. He has to be a hero of a romance rather than a figure with any kind of inter-reality. What is that little scene show you or tell us about gender in Venice? The scene of the courtship as it's described to us. What is Desdemona supposedly doing as she's listening to this account? She's doing housework of some kind. Yes, I imagine her dusting, but I'm sure that this is extremely, unhistorical. But ever the household affairs would draw her, then now for all I know, she's ordering food or she's commanding the gondolas to go back and forth. She's running the house anyway. Whatever she's doing, it's the domestic. And she's drawn away from the domestic. And she is the figure of the domestic. When she says to him, supporting Cassio is like wearing your gloves or keeping warm. She is the voice of the domestic to a certain extent. Domestic, again, meaning house. But the idea is that the household affairs would draw her away, and then she'd come back and with a greedy ear devour up our discourse, that she was hungry to hear. And this greedy ear, again, the ear as an open, as an orifice, her hunger, he imagines her as a desiring subject. He imagines her as somebody who has desires. And that her desire is for his narrative, for his story, for the story of Othello as a hero. And so we have this picture of, now where is Mrs. Brabantio? Or, Dame Brabantio, whatever she might be. Do we know? Did she ever show up in play at all? There's a very brief mention of her as, no longer with us. But, this is this characteristic Shakespearean structure in which you have one parent and one child. Very often it's a father and a daughter or a mother and a son here. We'll see other examples of this as well. So that, again, the relationship between Brabantio and Desdemona is overdetermined, that he is protective of her, he is possessive of her, he doesn't want her to give her away to his friend, Othello, to his equal, Othello, to the figure who was his house guest and who was his honored guest until the courtship made him rethink this figure and turn inside out all of his language of heroism. And this is the stranger business again, that you can be both the hero stranger and also the dejected or abjected stranger. precisely the thing that attracts Brabantio to Othello, the same, you know, not like Brabantio, has been every place, has, you know, has all these stories to tell, is also what makes makes him distrust him when he comes to be the suitor to his daughter. So this is the background against which the events in Cyprus take place. What about this notion of wit and witchcraft? Who mobilizes witchcraft in the play? Iago, okay, say what?
He's the one that seems to have the powers to poison people.
He says at one point in the play to Rodrigo, he says, "Thou knowest we work by wit and not by witchcraft. And wit depends on dilatory time." And this is this Iago as playmaker again. You know, you have to wait till things happen. I have it, he's engendered. Helen Knight must bring these this monstrous birth to the world's light. But in fact, black and white are completely. I mean, all the stereotypical cultural significations of black belong to white here, and all the stereotypical cultural significations for white belong to black. This is a play about about how black and white is how you can never see the world. But therefore, it is important, in fact, that there are these racial markers. And to go back to the topic that I began with, these earnest attempts to make the play colorblind, I think, were really attempts to disempower the play of exactly. And you know, again, they were well intentioned, but they're actually attempts to suggest something about the humanity of Othello, as if to associate him with racial identity was not to engage that same question. We're going to stop now and come back in 10 minutes and start again. Thank you.
I was taken aback by your opening comment that there was a critical school that said this was not about race. But so I was interested in what, in fact, is the best argument for that, and whether there are two plays here, two schools of thought. Because if it were truly about race, the Doge and the leadership would not have so affirmatively adopted Othello as leader and dismissed this upset contemporary important person. And they just toss him away when he comes in and says, "I have this major problem."
Sorry, when is this?
When he goes to the council, he goes to the Doge to... At the beginning, when
Brabantio goes,
goes to the father, goes to the Doge, he's just passed away.
Well, no, not quite. Let me say two things to begin with. One is that a 20th, 21st century notion of race and race problems is actually pretty different from how the 16th or 17th century might have thought about race or racial difference. The word race is, in this context, this is a modern use of the word race. If you find race as a word in Shakespeare's plays, it's going to mean heritage. It's going to mean family, actually. Well, it's not going to mean color.
With the language, okay, well then color, is it not a...
But to this point, I was just, again, talking in the break to somebody about why it is. Now again, we talked about public-private. The Duke, as he's called, has the council chamber in session because there's a problem of state, the problem of the Turks. Brabantio says to him, "I have a private matter I need to bring before you," and the Duke says, "Okay, well, let's talk about that first." But the reason that he sets aside the private matter is, why is it? I mean, who is it who convinces the Duke that it's not witchcraft that's being used here?
Desdemona says that she made the choice to be with Othello and that she wants to go with him.
The Brabantio says, this is exactly right, Brabantio says, you know, mistress, again, a very strange thing to call your wife, your daughter, mistress, do you see here, who in this assembly do you owe your duty? And she says, "I do perceive here a divided duty. I'm indebted to you, you're my father. But as much duty as my mother paid to you, this is where the mother comes in, my mother paid in choosing you over her father, so I owe to the Moor, my lord. To the Moor, my lord. So the again, she calls him by the race, nation, nationality name, and she calls him that in the same phrase as my lord. And earlier than this, when we get this whole, at this moment, we get the narrative of the courtship that we've talked about, the housewife narrative and so forth, the Duke says to Brabantio, I think this tale would win my daughter too. In other words, this exciting story that is the story of the hero Othello is so seductive that it seems to me perfectly reasonable, not like witchcraft, that she would fall in love with it. So he actually takes evidence. He takes evidence about the courtship, and he takes evidence from Desdemona testifying herself. And it's at that moment when she says, the Moor is my lord, I am married to him, I choose him. And as we were saying, this is a kind of move about the notion in the Bible that the woman is supposed to leave the father and cleave to the husband. But the woman doesn't usually get to say that. It's the two men who get to say that. Here's my daughter, now she's going to cleave to you. But it's the outspokenness of Desdemona, which is, again, her heroic, admirable moment here, which comes back to haunt Othello later on when she becomes outspoken on behalf of Cassio, when she begins to behave not like an obedient wife or an obedient daughter, but like a speaking subject. So I think that when the Duke, but I want to come back to you and see what you think about this, when the Duke decides that he can now go back to affairs of state and to the question of the Turks and indeed to the necessity of sending this very same Othello, whom we may say he needs and therefore has to take the side of anyway, but when he decides to go back to the issue of the Turks, it's because he feels that this domestic dispute in terms of its evidence, has been resolved. That it's not rape, and it's not witchcraft. It's marriage freely chosen by Desdemona.
I took that line by Desdemona to be, it's the same line that appears in Lear at the beginning. And I thought, well, I took it as not determinative of this, not as it important to the scene.
It's except that in Lear, she says, I choose you, Daddy.
Well, I choose you to the extent I owe to my father, but my husband to the extent that I owe to my husband.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Right.
But if this were truly color-based or prejudice-based, whether you're using race or color, in our world, at least, Othello would not be of such rank, would not be accorded such respect. It would be a very different response if it were truly a prejudiced society in terms of a reflection of the coarseness of the language. The language...
I'm not sure I understand. We've got the whole Clarence Thomas story on the pages of the paper. We've got Colin Powell. We have a hero general who is an African American. And he's not treated any differently as far as I can tell. He's not treated like the African American general, but rather like a graduate of West Point.
But our society may not be... This language is very coarse at the beginning about color. The play.
Yeah.
It is much coarser than discourse in our environment now. Public people don't... It's language out of the 1930s.
Yes, okay. Yes. Okay. All right.
So I don't think you can compare... I'm getting tangled up in this, but if that language was indicative of the racial or the color attitudes or prejudicial attitudes of the society, then Colin Powell or Othello would not be accorded such respect. In other words, there's an maybe it's your difference between public and private, but there is public respect. And maybe it doesn't, and I'm trying to deal with this question, it's not about race. There is public respect for Othello, which is quite different from the private discourse of what we're hearing in the
dialogue. This is complicated, remember that his achievements in the public world, which is the world of men, you think about Joe Louis or Jackie Robinson, or is different from the question of interracial sex and marriage here. And different from the question of a father's property in a daughter, which is another thing. And that issue, surely we can hope to think, is an issue that plays better in the 17th century than it does in the 20th or 21st century. But it's precisely this slippage between the supposedly public and the supposedly private. It's precisely the inconsistency with which, because this is the inconsistency that comes home to haunt Othello, that he sees himself in both of these things. He sees himself as the hero, would like to see himself as the hero. He has actually done all these things that he's boasting about. He is the general, he is the honored person, he is the person, he is the peacemaker, he's all these things. He's also suddenly the person accused of witchcraft, and he's also the person who will not give himself permission to be an erotic subject, for whom the notion of himself as an erotic subject runs against, it is all the fears that the society is pushing back against him. He has to be more civilized than the civilized. He has to be more Venetian than the Venetian. Whether we say that he has to be more white than the white, or whether just he has to be more inside than the insiders, he holds himself to a set of standards and a set of abstinences. When he says, for example, I want her to go with me to Cyprus, he says, this isn't because of sex. This isn't these effects in me defunct. I'm so old that, or I'm so mature that it's not the heat of sexual passion, but rather something else, something having to do with a larger view of marriage or of companionship that makes me want her to go with me. We may say he protests too much, that he wants very much to present himself as the non-animal, as precisely the opposite of all those shouted voices at the beginning, as precisely the opposite of the kind of figure that he then briefly performs himself as being when he has his fit and he shouts about noses, ears, and lips and so forth. He, we can say he's culturally repressed, whatever you want to say. He does not want to give, for whatever reason, because he's old, because he's a Moor, because he's not a Venetian, because his wife, whatever reason they might be, he does not want to give any hint of himself as a passionate, private person. And so that it's quite right to say that the war comes within himself. I think it's true that that race, color issues, inside, outside issues, help to make him the way he is. But he is subject to those repressions. And his worst enemy is himself, and we've said that too. That he's the one who doesn't love himself in quite this way. Yes, sir.
The race issue is somewhat subtle because he's not a member of a large class of people in Venice.
Yes,
he is an exotic.
Right.
He is
right.
An exotic who has come in with a high skill level at a very important job that's essential to the Venetian society. And one of the things about race is that people who are much lower, say, for example, in class than he is, such as Iago and Rodrigo, might feel that, how dare he be better than he is, than they are. And so that, therefore, the race issue comes out not directly as when he is a guest, but when he in some way threatens some economic or proprietal advantage that any of those characters have, such as Brabantio's interest in his daughter, such as Iago's interest in his advancement, or Rodrigo's interest in gaining the hand of Desdemona.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think that this is it's the opposite of value added. It's value taken away, so to speak. That when it when he becomes a threat of some kind or a competition or threatens to displace something or other, then suddenly they remember that he's black, and that this becomes a reason why. But behind it is a whole cultural history. Behind it is the history of the handkerchief, and behind it is the history of the adventures that he's had and so forth. It's not as if he is a third generation black citizen of Venice. And I say this because there are black people living in London at this time. This play is not performed in a society that never saw a black man. There are free blacks living in London at this time. Ben Jonson has a whole court mask called the Mask of Blackness, which is in which there's an anti-mask of black women, blackened women with black paint on their skins, who turn into the mask of into queens. That blackness is very much a topic that people are engaging right now, and you're quite right, using it for their own purposes. Let's come back, though, if we can, to whatever it is that seems to be producing self-doubt in Othello, whether it's what would be some reasons other than his race and his country of origin. Yes, back here, right behind you, Mel. Sorry.
His age, they don't specify. I don't think it's specified, but he is. It's implied that he's quite a bit older than Desdemona. Right.
Somewhat declined into the veil of years is what he says. Now, let me draw an analogy for a second. In some of Shakespeare's comedies, there's a blonde woman and a dark woman, or a tall woman and a short woman, and very often directors exaggerate these differences. You have very blonde and very dark, or you have very tall and very short, as in Hermia and Helena in Midsummer Night's Dream. In this play, too, it's easy to sort of take these people at their own words and say, yeah, he must be 60, and, you know, Iago is really 30, and right. But in fact, my guess would be that the age differences here are exaggerated by the speakers, that these are, that we're dealing with a culture of self-doubt and of difference-making, where what's more painful for the audience is not to see this old guy married to a young girl suffering because he's old, but in fact to see somebody who sees himself as somehow over the hill and who becomes more that way because he sees himself that way. Doesn't mean he isn't older than Iago. Certainly he's had lots of adventures, and he must have had them during some months and years. But it's everything he says about himself is a self-deprecation in a way. It's either a self-exaggeration or a self-deprecation. And so, rude am I in my speech? Again, nobody less rude in their speech than Iago. As we've said, the dirty language at the beginning of the play is Brabantio, is Rodrigo, is so forth. Nobody speaks with the eloquence and beautiful periods of Othello, which is why his breakdown is a breakdown in language. When he loses the capacity to hold a whole sentence together, when he has his fit, whatever kind of fit it is, and people have said it's an epileptic fit, people have said it's a kind of, in Renaissance physiology of this time, that kind of fit is sometimes compared to orgasm. So that people have said that this is a kind of a sexual breakdown, whatever it is. But when he has he goes into the trance, what leads him in that direction is a kind of loss of language, not the abjuration of language that we saw in Iago, not from this time forth, I never will speak word, but in fact the breakdown of the capacity to make language into a kind of order and into a kind of story, and it's from that breakdown that we see Iago beginning to take the real control of the second half of the play. Yes, sorry. Into the microphone, please. Sorry.
Is he like most characters, are most characters like him in Shakespeare? I mean, in the sense of there's always this split that's going to come out eventually, that what they look like on the surface is really a veneer, and that somewhere beneath that there's there is some weakness, I suppose you'd call it there, which Iago is able to exploit tremendously. But I mean, because there are some people have said Cassio is sort of the perfect, he wouldn't have had these self-doubts. He, or at least,
what's Cassio's Achilles heel, so to speak? What is Cassio's other side? He can't hold his range. No, I mean, because you see him, you see this perfect, brilliant intellectual.
Yeah.
First of all, you see him being rather like the phrase that Iago uses and that Othello uses for Desdemona, the super subtle Venetian. This very, very, you know, this notion, and that's the Machiavellian Venetian. That's the idea of the person who think you can trust, but you really can't. With Cassio, he's a kind of super subtle Florentine. He's too courtly with the girls at the beginning and so forth. But then you see that he's got this other side, which comes out when he drinks. And everybody knows that he's a bad drinker, but again, his language breaks down. For God, that was an excellent song. That was a better song than the other one and so forth. And you see him completely lose it. He becomes quarrelsome. He becomes irrational. So that he, too, has this other side that again, somehow Iago knows all these things and can exploit them. Sometimes, I mean, when the idea is, you know, that Shakespeare somehow understands the human person in some complicated way, what we actually get is the structure of an inside and an outside in precisely the way you're describing. But it's not always about weakness. I mean, it could, for example, Henry V, Prince Hal, looks like he's dissolute, and then he comes to the front of the stage and explains to the audience how much that this is a kind of plot and so forth, and he will turn into the great hero Henry V. And even in that play, we'll have his moments of self-doubt and then his moments of leadership and so forth. And that a conversation with yourself, or you know, Richard III, another example, any of these characters who are so-called Machiavels, of which Iago is one, a character who takes pleasure out of discomfiting other people, of manipulating people and so forth. Does Iago have a weakness? Does Iago have an interior that is available for attack or critique?
I'm really curious.
We have to wait for the microphone, sorry.
I'm really curious about Iago's suspicion about Othello.
Having an affair with his wife. Emilia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he also at another point in the play thinks that Cassio may have had an affair with his wife.
Right.
And there's, as you said earlier, there's no evidence. I didn't see any evidence for this at all. And yet, you know, where does this come from? And these are things he says in a soliloquy when he's alone on the stage.
Right.
So these are things he's really thinking.
Okay. So that is usually and probably right. However, think how disturbing it is for us if the convention of the soliloquy, which takes us into the confidence of the single speaker, is actually also containing lies that are manipulating us. This may be Iago making up stories to himself. You're quite right. Nobody's there for some of these conversations. But it may, I mean, one of the famous things about this play is that there's this one story. There's not a second, you can't ever take your eyes off what's happening to Othello and Desdemona and Cassio and Bianca and so forth. And that famously, there have been moments in the history of the production of the play in which somebody stood up in the audience and wanted to shout to Othello, "Don't trust him, he's lying to you, you know, she's faithful," and so forth. Because in most Shakespearean plays of this kind, there's somebody on the stage who says that for you. We'll see that in King Lear, we'll see it in Macbeth, we'll see it in lots of plays in which some deception is happening, and the audience gets some kind of relief, we'll call it kind of tragic relief, if you like, because there's somebody on the stage who understands. In this case, who knows but that Iago is also practicing upon us, that the very convention of the soliloquy, which seems to be that he tells us the truth, might itself also here be being broken. Back there, yes.
But his wife Emilia has very pragmatic views on adultery, and said that she wouldn't be unfaithful to her husband for cloth or gifts, but that if it would bring him the world, she would do it, and the world is it's a large place for a small sin.
Right.
So he has some reason to be suspicious of her, if those are her expressed.
Well, again, it depends upon how we understand, how we play that scene. It's a little scene toward the end of the play. Already the handwriting's on the wall. Already we can see that the wedding sheets are about to be laid on the bed. The wedding sheets are going to become the winding sheets and so forth. But this is girl talk. This is Desdemona and Emilia chatting away. Yes, do you want to talk to this question? Okay, please.
She does say that she would commit adultery to get the world for her husband. Wouldn't that imply that if she had slept with Othello, that she would try to influence him to promote Iago to his lieutenant?
Well, does everybody believe that when Emilia says the world's a great thing, it's a small price for it's a great price for a small vice? Does everybody believe that we're actually getting the truth about Emilia's morals here, and that she actually, if the occasion presented itself where she could sleep with somebody who would be of benefit to her husband, that she could do so? Is this manifest in this? It's what she says, but in what spirit does she say it? Microphones, please. Yes.
You see it in the Canterbury Tales, where the wife says, you know, like, I'll sleep with you if you, you know, get the rocks out of
In the Franklin's Tale, yes.
Yeah, uh-huh. So it saves my husband, but she's saying it just to make a point that, you know, that'll never happen. But she would do that for her husband. That's the extent she would go to.
Right, right, yeah.
I think it also refers to Isabella in Measure for Measure. The same kind of question was asked of her, and she wouldn't do it for the world. Are for her brother, but in this case, Emilia says, "Well, the world's a small,
that's
a
very
large
nice,
place."
That's a very nice analogy. Okay, and in both cases, I mean, Isabella is a figure of principle, and we may say of blind principle in a way that she, you know, that she's extremely definitive about this, and the fact that the brother is going to die is second, more than our brother is our chastity, and so forth. This is, you're quite right. This is the inverse of that. But it's all in, it's not, I mean, in the case of Isabella, Angelo's actually there saying, here's the key, meet me at night, let's do it. In the case of Emilia, it's a conversation between women in which I think it is also, I mean, one could perfectly well say, this is her philosophy of living and get along. It's the opposite of the idealizing Desdemona, the one entire perfect chrysolite, the alabaster woman, that this is the real ordinary woman. Yes, please.
But it strikes me that Emilia is really the only one who speaks in terms that are other than absolutes. Desdemona would never do it. Othello would never believe the jealousy. But she's the only one who sees shadings of behavior and sees possibilities that aren't strictly black or white.
Right. No, I think that's right. And she is also, turns out to be the figure of, I mean, when the question of the handkerchief comes up at the end, and when the question of the sexual jealousy, and Othello says, but your husband told me, and your husband, she said, my husband, she picks up this word over and over again, and she cannot believe it because she can suddenly see everything that has taken place. So let me just be clear about what I'm trying to say about this scene between the two women. I don't think that it is, I think it is perfectly possible to play the scene in which Desdemona is saying, I'd never do it, and Emilia is saying, you're a fool. The world is a complicated place. You have to make compromises. You might want to do it. You should. But it's also possible to imagine it as a kind of tease between the two of them, in which Emilia is poking fun at and trying to cheer up the extremely melancholy Desdemona. I mean, it's possible to deliver that line, it's a great price for a small vice, as a kind of joke as well as a credo. And I'm not saying that it's the one way or the other way. I'm saying that it's a line that actually can be played in a variety of different ways. I would not myself take it automatically as a sign of Emilia's own moral values, but rather as a certain kind of sophisticated and as you say, practical look at the world, but it may not reflect her own sexual intentions or presented with the Isabella situation, it might not be that she would function in quite that way. Yes?
But Desdemona's question to her is, I think Emilia's also attacking her in naivete, because what she says is, are there women who would do this?
Yes.
Are there women who would cheat on their husbands? Because she can't imagine it.
Right. It's interesting because we've had the relatively pragmatic Desdemona at the beginning of the play, choosing between the father and the husband. We've had I saw Othello's visage in his mind. There doesn't seem to be a kind of narrowness or naivete. But in this scenario, this is why the continuity of Shakespearean characters is sometimes complicated. Because in this scenario, she needs to be the figure of purity. She has become, in a way, this figure of who cannot believe that he could think this of her, because it's not what she believes about him. Please. Microphones. Anybody? I don't care. You guys.
In that scene, I keep thinking about this dichotomy between love and sex, and it seems that what Emilia is saying is, I love my husband. I love my husband so much, I would do that. And there seems to always be this, you know, again, this antagonism almost between the two, between love and sex. And that is how I read the scene between the two of them.
Well, let's also put into the mix here materiality, because we're talking about the traffic in women. We're talking about, and this is a case in which the woman becomes commercial. The woman herself, rather than being traded between men for sex, that she could become the agent of deploying her own sex for commercial gain to the husband. So this is we could associate this, to go back to Measure for Measure, with Mistress Overdone and the what it means to be a madam, what it means to that there's a sense in which she is here controlling the potential commerciality of her own sex, or her own sexuality, her own sexual availability, for the benefit of the husband here.
Bianca is the only person who has sex and love.
Exactly. And it's wonderfully ironic that Bianca is certainly the most naive woman and the least tawdry woman in the play, despite the fact that she is a courtesan and they treat her that way. She's in love. She's in love with Cassio. And his behavior toward her is surely one of less attractive than his drinking, in terms of how one might want to reevaluate Cassio. Somebody, please. Okay. Larry, then Mel. Larry's person, then Mel's person, please.
Well, I just thought we'd moved on, but back to the subject of the conversation between Iago's wife and
Emilia and Desdemona.
Mm-hmm. Emilia, in that moment, I thought was more showing her loyalty to Iago, and then sort of explaining why she steals the handkerchief later and that sort of thing. So I didn't think of it at all as her take on having sex with other men. I thought of it completely as her take on how loyal she was to her husband, mm-hmm. and that she would do anything for him.
Mm-hmm. Good. Okay, good.
Well, can I do two comments? And just relevant to that, I think it's very human. I've been in conversations when I have said, oh, I would never do that, or I would do that. It's only when you're faced with the decision that you know what you'll do. It's easy to pass it off because you're trying to make somebody feel better. So I sort of think the girl talk thing is important. And the other thing I wanted to ask, though, is that it seems to me Cassio was it the intent to make him weak? I mean, I think pleading his case before Desdemona, a man would go to the source, wouldn't he?
Well,
if he were
this is
in
a
fact,
man, and he didn't. Why doesn't he? He said, explains why he doesn't. Why doesn't Cassio go directly to Othello?
Oh, I guess I don't know.
Well, it's in the play. I mean, this issue is addressed.
I found myself wondering all the way through, so I missed.
Why does Desdemona become the agent for Cassio?
Iago drags him into this. I mean, sets it up for him, and he's gullible. And he's not. I mean, he's made a big mistake by getting drunk and misbehaving and right. Sort of loss of honor. So he's susceptible to the suggestion. And he's. I mean, I suppose you could say he's Florentine and Machiavellian. So you know that makes it even more susceptible.
Well, whether he's Florentine Machiavellian or not, it's quite right that Iago is behaving in a Machiavellian way. And this is another one of his little plays within the play. He sees an, you know, I mean, he's the guy who has set up the whole drunken Cassio business. He's got Roderigo and Cassio in this structure. He then moves on to Cassio, and he says, "I'll tell you what you can do. Go to Desdemona, and she'll plead your case. She'll help you out with this." I'm so mortified. I really am not myself. So that the idea here is that the wife would assist with it. This becomes again a private matter, rather than a public matter. That it goes through the female side here, and indeed, when she goes to plead with Othello. When she says, it's as if I would ask you to put your gloves on or stay warm or whatever it is, it's conceived of in the domestic world here. You could say that Cassio has been unmanned, whatever that would mean, by his drunkenness. He feels that way. He feels that he has lost control, that he has revealed himself to be not the person he's supposed to be. And that from that loss onward, I mean, we could also see then his boasting scene with Iago vis-a-vis Bianca as a restoration of his, you know, parade of maleness, of his that he has control over something, and the something he has control over is this woman who loves him, this woman whom he has no interest in marrying and is very explicit about the way he's going to use her. And he's going to use her not only sexually, but to do this taking out of the work, the handkerchief with its embroidery is going to be copied here by Bianca, that she becomes another kind of housewife for Cassio. But it's true that she is that this is an unusual route, but it's one that's prepared for in the play. Iago does it for him. Yes, sir. Wait.
Another reason that Desdemona becomes an agent for Cassio is that she feels a certain loyalty to him. He was sort of Othello's best man in the courting process.
Yes, right. But exactly. Notice how this is explained. He went between them often. That Iago wants to know from Othello, did Cassio know about your interest in Desdemona? Yes, it went between us very, very oft. Indeed, says Iago. Indeed, says Othello, by heaven thou echoest me, and so forth. And this Iago as echo is a big figure here. But the idea that, think about Diomedes in Troilus and Cressida, again, that the intermediary becomes the object of love, becomes the transferential object, or becomes the figure who actually keeps the lovers apart rather than bringing them together. That this going between them takes on a double meaning and also suggests an opportunity for Cassio, under the guise of courting Desdemona for Othello, to do some courting of his own. That the idea here that Cassio is the go-between for Othello, it's only a step to thinking that maybe he was actually courting for himself, and that's a pattern that you see in several other Shakespeare plays as well. Can we talk a little bit about the death scene? I don't know if we're going to have time to look at these passages or not, but let's talk a little bit about the scene at the end, because it, among the things, it contains some of the most magnificent poetry of the play. Somebody describe to me what happens at the end of the play. Why does it happen in bed?
Othello doesn't want to do anything to Desdemona that would leave a scar or a mark or cause her to bleed, so he... first of all, he thinks that it's justice to kill her in their marriage bed, which is supposedly she sullied it. Well, Iago plants the seed in his
head. He says it. He strangled her in the bed, even the bed she hath contaminated. He says it right out. Yes, yes, says Iago, says Othello, the justice of it pleases. So the idea, the scenario, again, is Iago's. And there's some confusion in the text as to exactly what the, you know, is she going to be strangled? Is she going to be stabbed? What, you know, what's the method of death going to be? So that the plot should wind up in bed again. Remember again what we said earlier about the deferral of consummation, or about the omnipresence of sexual desire here among many of these figures, circulating around many of these figures, as something that is always in the air and never clearly settled. And here, finally, you're going to see them in bed. Remember, opening scene, they're just outside the inn. Maybe they've been in bed or about to go to bed, but you don't see them. The scene in Cyprus with the bell, that he comes and he says, look, that my gentle love be now raised up. So you never see them in bed. And this is the back scene. This is also the scene, the very scene, but how different, that was predicted in the opening shouting under Brabantio's, now, an old black ram is tupping your white hue. So this animal imagery here is the image of people having sex in bed. And you only get it in everybody else's account until the very end of the play, when you suddenly get the bed. Yes?
There's also the comment about wishing their sheets happiness. In the beginning.
Yes, happiness to their sheets.
Happiness to their sheets.
Right.
And now, here are the sheets.
Exactly. You know, whose line is that? Do you remember?
Iago.
It's Cassio, actually. It's Cassio and Iago are talking, and Cassio's trying to Iago's trying to get Cassio to say something salacious about Othello and Desdemona. And Cassio, either because he's well-bred or because he's cautious, avoids the trap, you know. Well, you know, the wine she drinks is made of grapes. Iago does everything he can to get Cassio to kind of talk dirty with him about these people, and he keeps avoiding it. And finally, Cassio says happiness to their sheets, and this sort of closes the conversation in which Iago has turned. Iago, with various people, including with Desdemona and Emilia, is capable of kind of coarse language. We cannot get Cassio in this moment to speak about. Still, the sheets are there, absolutely. And as many critics have recently talked about, and as I'm sure I talk about in my chapter too, there's a connection between the handkerchief, also made of white linen, and the sheets. That, you know, it's white, but it's got red stains on it, and this idea of virginity, of consummation, of the wedding sheets showing, because again, the showing of the sheets is this idea that the woman was a virgin. That why do you care about that? Because your children will be your own children rather than somebody else's children. And again, this image at the very beginning of the play shouted out at Brontio's window about you'll have your nephews nay to you, you'll have genets for Germans and so forth, that your descendants are going to be animals because your daughter is having sex with an animal. This is the opposite of what we see at the very end. But this is the scene. This is the scene that you have not seen and not seen and not seen, and now you see it. And instead of seeing sex, you see death. What's Othello's behavior like in this scene? When he comes in with the torch, put out the light and then put out the light. Remember this famous speech. What's he doing?
It's almost like he's very struck by the line at the end of this, towards the end of this longer speech, and I will kill thee and love thee after.
Yes. Yeah. 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 Again, it's that he can only idealize her once he gets rid of the real her, which is actually not the real her, but has become the real phantasmatic her. He wants to get back to this idealization. I will kill thee and love thee after. Because we have so little time left, I'd like us to look not alas in any of the passages on your sheets, but on your sheets, there you go. Rather at Othello's speech to the assembled group in Act 5, Scene 2, about line 336, please. Soft you a word or two before you go. Can you join me there? I have done the state some service, and they know it. No more of that. Now look at the public-private here again. I pray you, in your letters. Now, who's he talking to here? I pray you in your letters. Yes, but especially the Venetian ambassadors, who are also Desdemona's relations. When you shall these unlucky deeds relate, and what does unlucky mean? Well, that's what they refer to, but why are they called unlucky? Just bad luck? It's a deep sense of, I mean, this is not, yes, go ahead, please.
Sort of destined by the stars to be ill-fated?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. It has a resonance about it that is more than just bad luck. Speak of me as I am. Now, here, I want you to remember Iago's I am not what I am. And this whole question, the question that we've been talking about whether a theatrical character, when he speaks to you directly, shows you himself or something honest about himself. Iago, I am not what I am. Here, speak of me as I am. Not so easy to know what that am is. Nothing extenuate. What does that mean, extenuate? What are extenuating circumstances? Excuses, right. Nor set down aught in malice. So don't make me look too good or too bad. Remember the modiflis malignity of Iago. Then must you speak of one that loved not wisely but too well, of one not easily jealous but being wrought perplexed in the extreme, of one whose hand, like the base Indian, threw a pearl away richer than all his tribe, of one whose subdued eyes, albeit unused to the melting mood, drops tears as fast as the Arabian trees, their medicinable gum. Set you down this, and say besides that in Aleppo once, where a malignant and a turbaned Turk beat a Venetian and produced the state, I took by the throat the circumcised dog and smote him thus. So what's happening at this moment? He's killing himself. But why tell this story about the malignant and turbaned Turk?
Isn't he identifying himself with the enemy?
He's identifying himself both with the enemy and with the hero. I, speak of me as I am, I, your Venetian hero, killed the turbaned Turk whom I am not. And again, it's a mistake to think of Othello as a Muslim. He's not. But the division here is here enacted and resolved by this self-slaughter. That you have the two Othellos, so to speak, here, present in his own mind. And it's at that, how does he resolve it? It's by killing the other one. And kill the other one, he also has to kill the one who speaks. Set you down this and say beside that in Aleppo once I took you by the throat the circumcised dog and smote him thus. Levico, oh bloody period, meaning end here. All that is spoke is marred. I kissed thee ere I killed thee, no way but this, killing myself to die upon a kiss. So here you have finally the love match. Here you have finally the consummation. Remember the early modern Renaissance pun on the word die, which means to have a sexual climax as well as to come to a mortal end. The much of the love poetry of the period, the poetry of John Donne, for example, talks about wanting to die with his beloved in bed. And here what's meant is to have sex. So this is that diapun that we see in Romeo and Juliet too, brought to a certain kind of literalization or what is sometimes called unmetaphoring. This figure of the little death and the big death, of the sexual death as contrasted to the final death of mortality, here becomes, both of them become performed at once. And this bed in which they never did find the time to make love becomes the place in which they make death together here. So that the end comes here with a return to the deferred beginning. Mel, are you okay? Who's left at the end of the play? Who's on stage? Cassio? Okay, and who else? Graciano? Lodvico? Iago. Look on the tragic loading of this bed. This is thy work. The object poisons sight. Let it be hid. The whole play has been the work of Iago in this way. And the tragic loading of the bed here is where we talked about Cassio bringing them together, going between them. Here is Iago as infernal matchmaker, bringing them together in the other death rather than in the little death. The object poisons sight, let it be hid. So the final gesture here, this is again a gesture that we see very often at the ends of these Shakespearean plays, is the instruction to retell the story. Myself will straight aboard and to the state this heavy act with heavy heart relate. Again, the rhymed couplet ends both the scene and in this case the play, but the invitation once again is that the state, that is us, I mean the survivors and the ordinary people, are going to hear this story and in the relating of it, the telling of it, is going to be a relation of a different kind that might in fact be a replaying of the play. So that the question of who is the victor here is very unclear. What do you think? What is anything resolved? Is anything redeemed here at the end of the play? Anything?
It's a total tragedy in that sense. I mean, it's hard to.
Sometimes you kind of talk about learning from a tragedy. Do the people on stage learn anything at all back there? Yeah.
As to learning from it, I would say no. But the one person who might come out a little bit better is Cassio, because the string of tragic events basically precluded another string of tragic events that would have led to his death.
Well, in fact, in purely material terms, he winds up as the governor of Cyprus, and he succeeds to the position of Othello. But this all looks like very, very secondary to this, to the domestic coming to the middle of the play. So one of the things that people say about this play is it's a domestic tragedy. It's a tragedy about private life. It's a tragedy about love. It's a love tragedy here. But it's a love tragedy that is enabled and disabled by notions of oneself in various public arenas, including the martial world, but also this world, this complicated world that we were talking about how race or color or otherness is valued and devalued and discussed, and how you take people at other people's valuation. That's one of the things that functions very powerfully in this play, that any sense of self that almost any character has here, except perhaps Desdemona, am I that word, am I that thing, that word that he said, almost everybody else gets their sense of self from another person or from another discourse out there. We're going from here to King Lear, is that right? Many of these same themes will return in that play, in which we'll see again the father and the daughter, and we'll see again the public and the private, and we'll see again the impossibility of full knowledge of somebody that you love. So, next time.
And I just wanted to mention quickly, we tried to be really explicit in the paper topics, but inevitably there will be questions. Please don't hesitate. Be in touch with your particular TF with any ideas or concerns or questions you might have about those.